This is episode number 37 of the Merry Podcast, entitled Snow. You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
I want to live again, and I want to look them straight in the eye, and I want to tell them what a cheap, lying, no-good, rotten, four-flushing, low-life, snake-licking, dirt-eating, inbred, overstuffed, ignorant, blood-sucking, dog-kissing, brainless...
Yeah, there's a lot of bad isms floating around this world, but one of the worst is commercial. Makeup, even in Brooklyn it's the same.
That thing had nine lives, she just spent them all.
Woo! I triple dog dare you!
I don't believe you're an angel. I think you're a demon right out of...
Oh, Henry, don't say that.
Does someone need a hug?
Tomorrow is Christmas. It's practically here.
Keep the change, you filthy animal.
Sentimental hogwash.
What was the last thing you and Charlie did before you went to bed Christmas Eve?
We shared a bowl of sugar, some shots of brown liquor. Played my shotguns, field dressed a cat, looked for women.
I'm the worst toy maker in the world. I'm a cotton-headed ninny muggins.
My mouth's bleeding, Bert! My mouth's bleeding! Doo-doo pedals! Doo-doo! There they are! Bert! What do you know about that? Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas and welcome to this, the 37th episode of the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com. My name is Jeff Westover, founder of My Merry Christmas, where we are in our 23rd year of being the internet's longest ongoing celebration of Christmas and the world's largest Christmas community. The Merry Podcast is a joint production of Merry Christmas Radio and Kringle Radio, our two year-round radio stations dedicated to all things Christmas. You can find Merry Christmas Radio on Live 365 and Kringle Radio at kringleradio.com. It's a favorite time of year for us, if only because we get to wander a bit in the forest of Christmas and get deep into topics that we just don't have the time for during the season. This time around, we take a healthy look at Christmas movies, and specifically, those classics of Christmas that were box office flops. It's a compelling list and quite a topic to explore. In addition, we outline the history of secular Christmas celebration. We spent a lot of time exploring the spiritual origins of Christmas, but now we flip the coin and talk about how the secular Christmas is not only a huge part of Christmas, but how it is affecting us today. This episode is awash in music, a lot of music that you will be sure to throw you back into the Christmas spirit, and will inform you on the ever-Christmassy topic of snow. Maureen from the Merry Forums guides us through that, and set your recorders because we have seven, count them seven, songs of Christmas all dedicated to the white stuff. To kick us off with that is Sissel with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir from their 2007 album, a runaway bestseller titled Spirit of the Season, and the classic hymn, In the Bleak Midwinter.
Island, water
You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
The connections between Christmas and snow are many, even though half the world experiences summer weather at Christmas time. The likely connection comes from the ancient origins of Santa Claus. Whether you believe in him from the northern countries of Norway, or even from ancient Turkey, the man in red was invariably shown in snowy scenes, or connected with flying reindeer that pranced in the snow. In the age of the modern Christmas, snow has become a romantic element. The music associated with snow makes Christmas the backdrop for love and family memories, as demonstrated in this recent hit from Amy Grant.
Little bits of heaven floating gently by the window. Soon this dirty city will be covered with a new snow. Let's put on our winter boots, go outside and play. Christmas can't be very far away. Weather girl says bundle up, it's gonna be a cold one. I'll put on my woolly hat, you'll wear your dad's old Stetson. Pretty lights everywhere, shining night and day. Christmas can't be very far away. Let's take a walk downtown and go dream shopping in the mall. The kids can do the Santa thing, photographs and all. We'll get the biggest tree this year and trim it to the top. And spend a whole lot more than what we got. But so what? Come next spring, I know we will. Ready for the sunshine. Right now throwing snowballs at each other's such a fun time. Kids will think we're crazy for a while and that's okay. Christmas can't be very far away. Christmas can't be very far away. A whole lot more than what we've got. But so come next spring, I know we will be ready for the sunshine. Right now throwing snowballs at each other's such a fun time. Kids will think we're crazy for a while and that's okay. Christmas can't be very far away. Christmas can't be very far away.
But for some time, snow was serious kid stuff in the business of Christmas. Frosty the Snowman came about only after the popular advent of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. The runaway sensation that Rudolph began unleashed several decades of various Christmas characters aimed at children. Frosty burst on the scene right after the song, made famous by Gene Autry about Rudolph, was released in 1949. Unlike other characters of Christmas, who just never captured the imagination of kids, there was just something in Gene Autry's storytelling Song of Frosty that made him a huge hit in 1950.
Frosty the Snowman was a jolly, happy soul, with a corncob pipe and a button nose and two eyes made out of coal. Frosty the Snowman made the children laugh and play. Were they surprised before their eyes he came to life that day? There must have been some magic in that old silk hat they found, for when they placed it on his head, he began to dance around. Oh, Frosty the Snowman was alive as he could be, and the children say he could laugh and play just the same as you and me. Sun was hot that day, so he said, let's run, we'll have some fun before I melt away. So down to the village with a broomstick in his hand, running here and there all around the square, saying, catch me if you can. He led them down the streets of town right to the traffic cop, and he only paused a moment when he heard him holler stop. For Frosty the Snowman had to hurry on his way, but he waved goodbye saying, don't you cry, I'll be back again someday.
There must have been some magic in that old silk hat they found, for when they placed it on his head, he began to dance around.
Oh, Frosty the Snowman was alive as he could be, and the children say he could laugh and play just the same as you and me. Thumpity thump thump,
thumpity thump thump,
look at Frosty go. Thumpity thump thump,
thumpity thump thump,
over the hills of snow.
For as much fun as snow is, it's long played to adult sensibilities at Christmas too. Jingle Bells is a song only associated now with Christmas. It's the biggest and most well-known song of Christmas that never actually mentions Jesus, Santa, or anything else even remotely Christmassy. When you hear the lyrics, you hear a happy tune that creates a Christmas party in an instant. But if you break down the words, the song is more about romancing in the snow. Most songs of Christmas associated with snow send a message of love, and many of them tend to be written during the heat of the summer. Mel Torme's Christmas song, that song of chestnuts roasting and Jack Frost nipping at your nose, was famously written under a blazing California summer sun. So too was the hit song Let It Snow. Written by composer Jules Stein in Hollywood during the record-breaking heat of 1945, Let It Snow was part of the magical decade of the 1940s that brought so many snow-themed Christmas tunes to the forefront, all probably designed to tug on the heartstrings of faraway servicemen pining for Christmas at home. White Christmas, I'll Be Home for Christmas, and even Let It Snow all painted pictures of home, typical to those fighting the war who missed it all so much. Recorded and released in 1945 as the war ended, Let It Snow was first made famous in this rendition from Bob.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I've bought some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight, how I hate going out in the storm. But if you really hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbying. But as long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. we finally kiss goodnight. How I hate going out in the storm, but as long as you hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbying. But as long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
But it was from the 1930s that the first big band snow-themed hit of Christmas first graced the airwaves of the radio and has gone down in history, as more than 150 artists have since that time released the song in nearly every genre of music. Winter Wonderland, like Jingle Bells and Let It Snow, never actually mentions Christmas, and it's heavy on romance. It was penned by Felix Bernard in 1934 with lyrics by Richard B. Smith. As the story goes, Smith was fighting tuberculosis in a facility in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where he would stare out the window over a nearby city park that turned into a winter wonderland as storms rolled through. Guy Lombardo made it a big hit in the 1930s, and Johnny Mercer reintroduced it to some success in 1946. But it wasn't until Perry Como got behind it in 1959 that the song took off, and began to be re-recorded by others nearly every other Christmas season since.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland. Gone away is the bluebird. Here to stay is a new bird. He sings a love song as we go along, walking in a winter wonderland. In the meadow we can build a snowman, then pretend that he is Parson Brown. He'll say, are you married? We'll say, no, man. But you can do the job when you're in town. Later on, we'll conspire as we dream by the fire to face unafraid the plans that we've made, walking in a winter wonderland.
Sleigh bells ring, oh, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight.
Walking in a winter wonderland.
Gone away is a bluebird. Here to stay is a new bird.
He sings a love song as we go along, walking in a winter wonderland.
In the meadow we can build a snowman, then pretend that he is Parson Brown. He'll say, are you married?
We'll say, no, man, but you can do the job when you're in town. Later on, we'll conspire as we dream by the fire, to face unafraid the plans that we've made, walking in a winter wonderland.
We'll be happy in love as two turtle doves, living in a fairyland.
Oh, we'll be walking in a winter wonderland.
A sure sign that a song reached maximum saturation at Christmas and total recognition in the marketplace is when it becomes lampooned on comedy records and television specials. Winter Wonderland, a completely secular song, is a pretty safe target, and nobody lampooned it better than Bob Rivers, who turned the song into walking around in women's underwear in 1993.
Lacey Beans, the wife is missing. Didn't I? I'm wearing her clothes, her silk pantyhose, walking round in women's underwear. In the store, there's a teddy with little straps like spaghetti. It holds me so tight, like handcuffs at night, walking round in women's underwear.
In the office, there's a guy named Melvin. He pretends that I am Murphy Brown.
He'll say, are you ready? We'll say, whoa, man. Let's wait until the wife is out of town. Later on, if you wanna, we can dress like Madonna. Put on some high shade and join the parade. Walking around in women's underwear. Lacy things, missing, didn't ask permission. Wearing her clothes, silk pantyhose, walking around in women's underwear. Walking around in women's underwear. Walking around in women's underwear.
No examination of Snow and Christmas would be complete without a look at Baby It's Cold Outside, a song that, like so many classic love songs of Christmas, dates back to the 1940s, and one that has enjoyed a resurgence in modern popularity thanks to the movie Elf. Written by Frank Loesser in the mid-1940s for his wife Lynn Garland, the song may never have been originally intended for publication. Somewhat racy and suggestive, even for today's world, the song is performed as a playful conversation between two people. Even the original score labels one as the wolf and the other as the mouse. They've returned to the wolf's home after a date, and the mouse decides that it's time to go home. But the wolf flirtatiously invites her to stay, as it's late and it's cold outside. Every line in the song features a statement from the mouse, followed by a response from the wolf. Usually the wolf part is sung by a male, and the mouse by a female. Critics of the song suggest that the wolf is pursuing the mouse too aggressively, and that mouse puts up only a token resistance, all supposedly pointing to loose morals that shouldn't be associated with a Christmas song. Statements such as, I really must go, the neighbors might think, and my father will be pacing the floor, do more than suggest typical holiday cheer. What's Snow got to do with it? Well, it's the reason for the stay, so to speak. Like other songs associated with the Christmas season, this one as well has enjoyed interpretation from a variety of artists. Dean Martin's version appears to have had the longest staying power of all that's out there, probably because he plays a better wolf than just about anyone else. Here he is, posthumously performing in an overdubbed version with Martina McBride from 2010, the one conservative radio host called a liberal hostage rape fantasy.
It's cold outside.
I gotta go.
But
away.
Baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you drop
so
in.
Very nice.
I'll hold your hands, they're just like
my
ice.
Mother will start to
beautiful,
worry.
What's your
and father hurt? Will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace.
So
roar.
Really I'd better scurry.
Beautiful. Please don't
or
hurry.
Maybe just a half a drink more.
Put some records on while I
the
pour.
Neighbors might
baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this
no
drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew
your
how
eyes are like starlight
to break
now.
This spell.
I'll take your hat, your hair looks
I
well.
I ought to say no, no, no,
mind
sir.
If I'm moving closer.
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurt? My pride.
I really can't stay.
Baby, don't hold out.
Baby, it's cold outside.
We'll be right back.
how lucky that you dropped
in. So nice and warm.
Look out the window at the storm.
My sister will be suspicious.
Gosh, your lips look delicious.
My brother will be there at the door.
Waves upon the tropical shore.
My maiden man's mind is vicious.
Gosh, your lips are delicious.
Well, maybe just a cigarette more.
Never such a blizzard before.
Gotta get home.
Maybe freeze out there. It's up to your knees out there.
You've really been great.
I thrill when you touch my
but
hand.
Don't you see?
How can you do this thing to
There's
me?
There's bound to be talk tomorrow.
Think of my lifelong
At
sorrow.
Least there will be plenty implied.
If you've got pneumonia and
I really can't
get
stay.
Over that old doubt. Baby, it's cold. Baby, it's cold outside.
Perhaps no other song embraces snow as a theme of Christmas more than one first made famous by Bing Crosby in 1950. Like the others, this song doesn't mention Christmas so much as it implies it, and it too features romance.
It's a marshmallow world in the winter when the snow comes to cover the ground. It's the time for play. It's a whipped cream day. I wait for it the whole year round. Those are marshmallow clouds being friendly in the arms of the evergreen tree. And the sun is red like a pumpkin head. It's shining so your nose won't freeze. The world is your snowball, see how it grows. That's how it goes whenever it snows. The world is your snowball, just for a song. Get out and roll it along. It's a yum, yummy world made for sweethearts. Take a walk with your favorite girl. It's a sugar date. What if spring is late? In winter, it's a marshmallow world.
It's a marshmallow day in the winter when the snow comes to cover the ground.
It's the time for play. It's a whipped cream day.
And we wait for it the whole year round.
Just you remember that those are marshmallow clouds being friendly
in the arms of the evergreen tree.
And the sun is red like a pumpkin head.
It's shining so your nose won't freeze.
You must remember that the world is your snowball. See how it grows. That's how it goes whenever it snows. The world is your snowball, just for a song. Get out and roll it along. It's a yum, yummy world made for sweethearts. Take a walk with your favorite girl. It's a sugar day,
but if spring is late, in winter it's a marshmallow world. In winter it's a marshmallow world. In winter it's a marshmallow world.
You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
Thank you.
comes alive every holiday season with lists of the best of and worst of when it comes to Christmas movies. But Christmas as a movie genre is a bit different than general run movies. Some movies at Christmas are so bad, they're good. And some are just ill-timed and become more appreciated as time goes on. Complicating matters is the fact that Christmas movies cannot be judged fairly according to box office dollars. After all, the Ron Howard live-action movie of the year 2000, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, is still the number one grossing Christmas movie of all time, with more than $260 million in global sales. That movie is topping no list, however, or even fondly remembered as a Christmas classic. Other criteria when it comes to even labeling a film a classic is completely different when it comes to Christmas. For example, Gone with the Wind is a no-doubt Hall of Fame classic American film, but has it been watched as much as, say, It's a Wonderful Life? How many of the millennial generation can even say they've seen Gone with the Wind, and how many can say they have avoided A Christmas Story? Clearly, Christmas movies are different, but they start out as all movies do. A studio produces it and sells tickets to see the film on the big screen in a theater. Using that as our criteria, here are the top five flops of Christmas and the results that just might surprise you. Starting at number five is Miracle on 34th Street, not the original, but the remake of Christmas 1994. I've often wondered what this movie would have done if it weren't up against the beloved original. I can recall at the time how much the critics howled that this movie was even being attempted. And the critics had good reason to howl. Every attempt to remake the original for television in the 1970s was absolutely horrid, but this movie of 1994, for as much as the storyline was known, endured a clever rewrite that was actually quite endearing, stepping up to take a larger, more sentimental role in this version is the lawyer character played this time by Dylan McDermott.
This seems like a pretty pointless exercise, Brian.
I know, but I just thought as long as we were here, might as well stop by and say hello to the old guy. Look at him.
Why?
Well, let's just say for the sake of argument that there is a Santa Claus and that you don't believe in him. Is it worth the risk that you might not get anything for Christmas this year?
Well, I didn't believe in him last year, and I still got everything I asked my mother for.
Yeah. You get a free candy cane?
I'm trying to limit my intake of sugar.
Miracle on 34th Street has gained new appreciation through the power of Netflix and Amazon, both who have offered it for free in recent years for streaming on televisions and devices. Though the movie opened to just $2 million in 1994, it has gone on to make tens of millions more outside of its theatrical release. Number four on our list of Christmas movie flops is The Telling of the Christmas Story from the Bible, made in 2006. Titled The Nativity Story, this movie underwhelmed critics and moviegoers when it opened to just $7 million on nearly 3,100 screens with a massive publicity campaign that never paid dividends. Being religious in nature, the film drew criticism for some depictions of the angel Gabriel and for the real-life fact that star Keisha Castle Hughes became pregnant out of wedlock during the filming of the movie. Here's a clip.
An angel told you this, that you would bear the Son of God. Mary.
Elizabeth had a baby, even in her old age.
Elizabeth has a husband!
Women have been put to death for this. They could stone you in the street.
Do you understand?
You should have stayed with Elizabeth.
Father. Father. I have broken no vow.
Oh, you have broken every vow, Mary.
The life of Christmas movies tends to shift as time advances. A Nativity Story has gained traction every year since it was released through DVD and Blu-ray sales and continual replay on premium movie channels. Unlike more popular screen releases such as How the Grinch Stole Christmas and Disney's 2009 stop animation version of A Christmas Carol, both of those starring Jim Carrey, by the way, A Nativity Story has year on year sold out previous year's numbers. Will it reach the level of a Christmas classic? Well, it's hard to tell still, but it is tracking well, and it continues to get notice of Christmas fans every holiday season. Number three on our list of Christmas flops is The Muppet Christmas Carol, the 1992 attempt of Kermit and Company to tell the Christmas ghost story of Dickens. While it is most definitely considered a classic now, one that draws the love and attention of both kid and adults alike each holiday season, there was a great deal of consternation about this movie at the time. After all, it was the first Muppet movie since the sudden passing of Muppet creator Jim Henson. Kermit had gained a new voice with Steve Whitmire, and Jim's son Brian took over the directing duties. There were a lot of worries about this movie, and some thought that Walt Disney, which had acquired the Muppets a few years prior, were simply milking the franchise. The result, however, was quite different.
Christmas is a very busy time for us, Mr. Cratchit. People preparing feasts, giving parties, spending the mortgage money on frivolities. One might say that December is the foreclosure season.
Harvest time for the moneylenders.
Hey, boys, have some tea. Come on, do it now.
If you please, Mr. Scrooge, it's gotten colder. Yeah. Any bookkeeping staff would like to have an extra shovel full of coal for the fire?
We can't do the bookkeeping.
Yeah, all of our pens have turned to inksicles.
Yeah, our assets are frozen.
How would the bookkeepers like to be suddenly...
unemployed!
This is my island in the sun.
I believe you convinced them once again, Mr. Scrooge.
Many expected The Muppet Christmas Carol to be an embarrassing flop. While it didn't set the box office on fire, it did do $5 million pretty weak for many films at the time, but not bad considering it was only carried on 2,000 screens. The biggest problem this movie had that year was that it came up against the release of two other Disney-related releases that holiday season, Home Alone 2 and Aladdin. Where the movie really became a star was on DVD, and it is another that has become a classic almost entirely through in-home viewing. Unlike others on our list, A Muppet Christmas Carol has not seen wide distribution on cable, network, or even streaming channels, but it wields a mighty influence on DVD and Blu-ray, and nobody expects that to slow down. Number two on our list is a movie that competes with Christmas Vacation as the most quotable of Christmas movies out there. Everyone seems to know this movie. Yet when it arrived on big screens in 1983, almost no one saw it. The story is nostalgic but unique, and it contains elements of suggestive sex, profanity, and a less than welcoming Santa Claus to boot. It is, of course, a Christmas story.
But what is it?
Well, it's a lake, you know, like in a statue.
Statue?
Yeah, statue.
Yeah, statue.
Ralphie?
My mother was trying to insinuate herself between us and the statue.
Holy smoke with you. Do you know what this is? This is a lamp.
It was indeed a lamp.
Isn't that great? What a great lamp.
I don't know.
Hey, hold it. Hold it here.
The old man's eyes boggled.
Oh, wow.
Overcome by art.
And I know just the place for it. Right in the middle of our front room window.
A Christmas Story debuted on Thanksgiving weekend in 1983, but was gone from most theaters by Christmas of that same year. The rights to the film were purchased by Turner Entertainment in 1986 and were transferred later to Time Warner. What those two groups have in common is cable television, and A Christmas Story has gone on to a prolific life as a cable rerun. In fact, entire marathons these days are dedicated to the film, gaining the fans it could never find back in 1983. In 2007, AOL called it the number one Christmas movie of all time, and the same year, IGN ranked it as the top holiday-themed movie of all time. A 2012 Marist poll named the film the most favorite holiday movie in the United States. But coming in at number one on our list of Christmas movie flops is a movie that almost needs no introduction today. It is considered by several prestigious film institutes as the most inspiring movie of all time and the classic standard of all Christmas movies.
How'd you know my name?
Oh, I know all about you. I've watched you grow up from a little boy.
What are you, a mind reader or something? Well, who are you, then?
Clarence Oddbody, AS2.
Oddbody? AS2, what's that, AS2?
Angel, second class.
It's a Wonderful Life bombed when released in theaters, losing more than $500,000 $1,947, a devastating loss for a movie its makers hoped would compete for several Academy Awards. Critics saw the film as overly sentimental, Pollyannish, and to add insult to injury, even the FBI condemned the film, issuing a statement that said, in substance, that the film represented rather obvious attempts to discredit bankers by casting Lionel Barrymore as a Scrooge type so that he would be the most hated man in the picture. This is a common trick used by communists, the FBI claimed. In addition, this picture deliberately maligned the upper class, attempting to show the people who had money were mean and despicable characters. It's a Wonderful Life was nearly lost to the ages as the copyright expired and the film was largely forgotten until resurrected by budget-minded television operators who grabbed the film as a late-night offering during the holiday seasons of the late 1970s. Year after year, the movie played, and over time, it slowly gained in popularity and in influence. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal in 1984, Frank Capra said, "It's the damnedest thing I've ever seen. The film has a life of its own now, and I can look at it like I had nothing to do with it. I'm like a parent whose kid grows up to be president. I'm proud, but it's the kid who did the work. I didn't even think of it as a Christmas story when I first ran across it." Christmas movies will continue to be made, and we're certain to get more classics in the future. And unlike any other genre of movie watching, the movies that become classics may not, in fact, become box office hits. That singular distinction not only holds true for movies, but also for music. Artists tend to live on through time just as much through their Christmas music than through their regular fare. Christmas, of course, is the reason behind such love. It, too, like the music and movies attached to it, remains beloved of people who continually work to reshape and to redefine it.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny little tots with their eyes all aglow, they know that Santa's on his way. He's bringing lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how. Offering the simple prayer to kids from 1 to 92. Though it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to send you a
Join us December 23rd on Kringle Radio for Tracking Santa Around the World. Brought to us through SantaUpdate.com, our live North Pole broadcast begins at 6 a.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. in London, 3 p.m. in Moscow, and straight up at midnight in New Zealand. Featuring 50 hours of continuous coverage, we will have music, interviews, and live updates from the North Pole, a worldwide exclusive only here on Kringle Radio.
In the news over Easter weekend was word from the ever-contentious state of Wisconsin in the USA about what they are now calling the War on Easter. Yes, it never stops, and the story is a familiar one. A group of religious folks posted a display in the state capital of Wisconsin fraught with religious symbolism and connected with the Christian celebration of Easter. That meant that the Freedom From Religion Foundation had to put up a contrary display mocking religious belief. There was a tussle, the sign from the Freedom From Religion Foundation got a bit mangled, and the whole sordid episode made a little splash in the media, but nothing like what we see of similar events associated with Christmas each year. In reviewing this, it is quite obvious why so few are talking about it. Easter is a purely religious holiday. It is noted on the American calendar, but it is not a federal holiday. The presence of Easter on public property is indeed a dubious thing for reasons even beyond the arguments of church and state. But Christmas has a presence on public property, and for all the secular reasons we have talked about before. Christmas, after all, has always been viewed secularly by the federal government. Way back in 1870, Christmas was declared a holiday by Congress in a way that nobody acclaimed or really cared about. It was established in answer to a complaint by federal workers that they be given the day off like their private sector counterparts, who by tradition, and for reasons known alone to various employers at the time, gave them Christmas off every year. The bill was crafted declaring the reason for the holiday to be one of a labor concession. And that was it. The truth of the matter was that Christmas, while held by many for different reasons all over the United States, was viewed even then, both in secular terms and in sacred terms. In fact, taking a close look at Christian denominations from the 18th and 19th centuries, it is clear that Christmas has always been more of a secular observance that folks tried to attach spiritual meaning to rather than the other way around. That, by the way, was not uncommon for any holiday that people would observe, whether it was recognized by the federal government or not. St. Patrick's Day, for example, has never really been about St. Patrick in America. It's always been more about beer. The attachment of something spiritual to it has come after the fact, and that is more the norm. In fact, if there is one truly spiritual day of observance in the United States, it is found in Thanksgiving, which by proclamation and design has always been a government-induced acknowledgement of God, a fact lost on pro-religion and anti-religion forces altogether. Thanksgiving is the only holiday on record where the government has declared anything remotely spiritual. So the argument in the history of Christmas becomes kind of a chicken and the egg kind of thing. Which came first, the secular Christmas or the sacred Christmas? You know from listening to past episodes of the Mary Podcast where we stand on this. Christmas predates Christ and even pagan celebrations of the winter solstice for centuries, and scriptural evidence supports the sacred celebration of Christmas in abundance over the course of recorded history. But the secular observance of Christmas has a history too, and we can largely thank the early Christian church for that. As many historians note, the early church fought fiercely against the raucous celebrations of the winter solstice, so much so that their efforts to upend those events by attaching sacred meaning to them actually had the reverse effect than intended. Rather than taking the focus off the year-end dead of winter holiday season, it enhanced them. Ancient holiday practices of role reversal were actually adopted in some parts by the church, where the boy bishop ruled over churchgoers in a game similar to secular traditions of the time. This marriage of secular and sacred within the church led out to other times of the year and other practices that many frowned on, especially those far-flung outreaches of the church thousands of miles away from Rome. Nowhere was that discontent more widely denounced than in merry old England. When King Charles ruled, he declared it his divine right as king from God himself to rule the church as well as the people, and open rebellion ensued for decades in a bloody battle of church versus state. Christmas was but a small part of a greater overall struggle of spiritualism versus secularism. In America, we note that the two kinds of Christmas, all the way back to the pre-colonial period, tied to this struggle in England. Two groups, the Pilgrims and the Puritans, brought their attitudes about Christmas with them to American shores. The Pilgrims of Jamestown and the colony of Virginia famously celebrated Christmas. The Puritans of Massachusetts colony famously did not, at least for several decades. For both, the secular celebration of Christmas was one of the things they were trying to escape. Both Puritan and Pilgrims alike wanted the sacred Christmas to lead out in establishing new societies. Pilgrims thought they could observe the day as one of holy acknowledgement, while Puritans thought it better not to profane the name of God by not making merry at all. Either way, their motivations for Christmas were entirely spiritual, and they wanted nothing more to do with the traditional excesses and merrymaking associated with the season by their forefathers in Europe. So how then did secular celebrations in America take root? Look no further than New York City, which at that time was known as New Amsterdam. As it would later come to be cherished, New Amsterdam was a melting pot, even then the great center of immigration to America. Irish Catholics, English Protestants, Italians, Norwegians, Poles, Germans, and countless other nationalities, it seems, blended in this pre-colonial America in this one very diverse spot. While some there held to sacred traditions from the lands they came from, others embraced the traditions brought by others. This was where the real birth of Christmas in America transpired, and the secular Christmas ruled the day. In fact, it created all kinds of problems for decades in what would become New York City. Streets were crowded, drinking was prolific, music was loud, gunfire was frequent, and fighting was common on the day everyone came to call Christmas. In Massachusetts colony and the settled villages of New England to the north, Christmas was barely acknowledged. But in areas of Virginia and all points south, Christmas was received by church bells, prayers, and subdued gift-giving. By the time the first generations of white Anglo-Saxon pure Americans were born during the years of the American Revolution, the dichotomy of both the sacred and secular celebration of Christmas was firmly established. Historians don't really want to acknowledge the modern Christmas before Dickens, but in truth and actuality, it has always existed on American shores. George Washington and other founding fathers celebrated Christmas in both sacred and secular ways. So too did Lewis and Clark. Andrew Jackson kept Christmas, as did President and Mrs. Madison. The Adams family of Massachusetts kept Christmas, as did slaves in the American South, all well before the year 1825. Christmas then, as it is now, was diversely observed, and for some, even argued about. Don't look for the separation, the argument, and the debates to end anytime soon. Interestingly, recent polls show us more divided than ever on the sacred or secular nature of Christmas. A Pew poll in December declared loudly that Christmas today is more secular than sacred, a poll we dispute because it has already been debunked by other polls. Over this past Easter weekend, the metrics of internet search indicate more interest in religion at Easter and Christmas than any other time of the year, an indication that spiritual acknowledgement of Christmas is still an issue, even if it cannot be measured against the mighty dollars of commerce. Personally, I don't understand why people have to argue over it. Let each keep Christmas in their own way. Christmas isn't one or the other. It is simply both.
"'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a sound could be heard, no barks or meows. Not a creature was stirring, but lay perfectly still in accordance with custom and law and God's will. The Bible was placed by the chimney with care in hopes of some preaching and an hour of prayer. The children were sleeping all snug in their beds, flat on their backs, and their neatly combed heads were turned at right angles, all parallel, and their hands at their sides and their chests rose and fell, quietly breathing and dreaming good thoughts as they'd been trained since they were small tots. And Mama in her nightgown, tightly buttoned to the throat, lay sleeping in bed where I sat and wrote by lamplight a list of righteous precautions I found in St. Paul's letter to the Colossians. When out on the lawn there arose such a sound as if something from heaven had dropped to the ground. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new fallen snow, though when I say breast, it's a metaphor, you know. The moon on the snow made it all bright below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a man whose visage was dark and severe, dressed in black hat and a black woolen cloak, and he lifted his head and he solemnly spoke, "Wickedness, turpitude, scandal and shame, laziness, lust, I call you by name. Man's sinful nature, his decline and his fall, I've come to do battle and vanquish you all who have strayed from the truth and wandered and sinned. As dry leaves that fly up before a great wind, so up to the housetop the gentleman flew with a bag full of cinders and lumps of coal too. As I drew in my head too astonished to think, down the chimney he came as quick as a wink. He was dressed all in black from his head to his foot. He was covered with ashes and cinders and soot. His eyes, how they glared. His pupils were burning. His cheeks were like glaciers. His dimples, there were none. His eyes were bright red and his nostrils were redder, and his nose was so sharp it could open a letter. His mouth was jagged with razor-sharp teeth. There were six on the top and two fangs underneath. He had a long face and his belly was bony that shook when he spoke from sheer acrimony. He was skinny and hard, a righteous old elf, and I shuddered, though I am a Baptist myself. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and consulted a list that some diligent clerk had kept of the children's failings and flaws, grammatical errors and social faux pas, all the things they had done that of course they shouldn't have, and the good things they did that were not quite good enough. Every act that was lax or unorthodox, and he filled all the stockings with sharp little rocks and cinders and thistles and ugly toadstools, except for my stocking, which he filled with bright jewels. And shaking his head, he drew his cloak tight, and I heard him exclaim ere he rose out of sight, "Let the children be quiet, no running, no noise, and be satisfied with small rocks for their toys. And let them spend Christmas in patient forbearance and fast and be silent and wait on their parents."
That was Garrison Keillor from A Prairie Home Companion Christmas and his spiritual rendition of 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, just another take on the spiritual side of the holiday. That wraps up this episode of the podcast, but we encourage you before we leave that if you haven't been around the forums, the Facebook pages, or the Twitter feed of My Merry Christmas, that you stop on by and say hello. Maybe share your plans for the summer with us. It would be nice to hear from you. If you are an artist with music to share, or perhaps an expert with an idea for the Merry Podcast that you'd like to get out there, don't hesitate to email me, jeff@mymerrychristmas.com. to discuss the possible inclusion of your Christmas with our audience here on the Merry Podcast. Of special interest over the months ahead would be the big events and locations around the world. We'd like to hear more about Christmas in your neck of the woods, what makes it unique, and what events are held, and perhaps even have some discussions with those who pull them off. Thank you for joining us on this Merry episode, and we invite you to take in every past episode archived online for us at christmaspodcast.com. We thank all the artists and contributors who have made this episode of the Merry Podcast possible, including John Schmidt, who provides our theme music for this and every episode, and also 101 Strings Orchestra, Kurt Bester, Amy Grant, Perry Como, Gene Autry, Martina McBride and Dean Martin, Bob Rivers, Bing Crosby, Michael Hall, Sissel and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, Garrison Keillor from A Prairie Home Companion Christmas. For all of us on the Merry Network and at MerryChristmas.com, this is Jeff Westover wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas.